This episode of Radio West contains strong language. Listener discretion advised.
He doesn't like it, but John McWhorter often has to get the disclaimers out of the way before he can make his case. He's a black liberal academic who believes racism has shaped the American experience. He believes protests are proper expressions of defiance and change. But he thinks these movements of social upheaval can become excessive and irrational. He says he first noticed it and his gut reaction to it in 1996. He was teaching at UC Berkeley at the time. Californians had voted to ban the UC system from using racial preferences in its admissions decisions, basically repealing a form of affirmative action. And McWhorter says he looked around the campus trying to make sense of what he was seeing.
All people who I thought of as my people were absolutely outraged that racial preferences had been banned at University of California schools. And my impulse was to understand and to be with them. That's the genuine truth. I thought the reasons that people are giving for being so upset don't quite sound right to me, but there's clearly something I'm missing. And I wanted to feel the way everybody else felt. And it just didn't work. What we were being told was that the ban on racial preferences was callously refusing to give a leg up to poor black kids from Oakland's inner cities. But it was painfully clear that very few of the black kids at Berkeley in this time were of that background. These were middle class kids. And I thought, okay, there's some cultural factors here that are nobody's fault. But the idea that banning preferences means that nobody will change standards for poor kids is not an empirically valid defense of being so against the ban on racial preferences. And yet I found gradually that you couldn't have a conversation about this sort of thing, referring to the facts, with really anybody. There was something going on beyond just engaging with fact. And I have this disease where I'm just not great at tolerating cognitive dissension. I wanted to feel like everybody else, but I also gradually came to realize that everybody was doing a kind of performance. And I wanted to know why, but I ended up writing a book. And that is how it all began. But it started with the difference between the facts about race and Berkeley and the story that people were telling about the ban on racial preferences and what it meant.
Did you really get hissed at a debate?
There was one debate, and I'm not going to name who it was with because I don't want it to get ad hominem. It was nakedly biased and extremely hostile. And the debate was me making my case and this person pretending to have read the book and basically giving an ad hominem, you know, dress down of me to a very enthusiastic audience. And, you know, I understood. I got it. It was not an audience full of terrible people. They were misled by him, misled by the media, misled by certain general notions of what black authenticity is. And they just weren't interested in giving me a hearing. It surprised me how little this affected me. And I think some people would say, no, it must have. And I say in response, no, it didn't, because I really did feel like I was saying things that made sense, and it's just that the people were not in a position to hear me. And that's kind of been the story of me and race issues ever since. If I sit down and think it out, then no one is going to tell me that I'm wrong just because what I'm saying doesn't have the right smell. And I guess that was the beginning of it. And here we are 20 years later, and I'm still just trying to tell my truth.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John McWhorter tells his truth in a new book that just came out this week. It's called Woke Racism. And the title is a pretty good synthesis of what he says he's seeing in this current conversation about race that ignited when George Floyd was killed last year. McWhorter believes much of the more extreme anti-racism activism that has emerged out of this moment isn't actually helping black people. He says the activists, many of them liberal white people, are intolerant to dissent. They lack nuance and perspective. They're obsessed with punishing dissenters. He says it's a new religion, and that's not just a metaphor. McWhorter is a linguist who teaches at Columbia University. He also writes a newsletter for the New York Times opinion section. And he told us his new book practically leapt out of him last year.
Well, in the summer of 2020, very suddenly there's the idea that we're having a racial reckoning after what happened to George Floyd. Okay, but what's the reckoning? And for a great many people, the reckoning meant, in shorthand, that a radical, hard leftist and prosecutorial approach to racism was now going to be the norm. And that the racial reckoning now meant that, I think what a lot of these people thought it meant was that white people who do bad things are going to be called out for it. But that's not what was going on. What was going on was a kind of reflexive, postural spraying for supposed evidence of racism that most sane people even 2 or 3 years ago would not have recognized as racism. And I started watching people getting dismissed and castigated on Twitter and fired and held out to dry for these non-transgressions, with people standing by. And it must be clear that I'm talking about white people as much as, and frankly, more than black people. People standing alongside and calmly saying, this is the racial reckoning. We're calling people to account, as if this was truth. And I thought, no, this is not truth. This is their opinion. And the only reason that so many, frankly, more sensible people are standing by letting this sort of thing happen is because they're scared. Because these people, if you go against what they say, call you out on Twitter as a white supremacist, and most people, understandably, aren't up for that. That crested so much that by June 2020, I thought, I don't like it. And I thought, I know that I'm not alone in not liking it among people both black and white. And I thought, somebody needs to say something about this who is neither young nor old. So you can't say that the person hasn't been around enough or is some kind of opportunist, but you can't say that the person is from a different time and doesn't understand what's going on the ground. But then it also has to be somebody black so that you deflect the whole racist charge. You can call me self-hating, but nobody really means it. And I thought, in a way, I have a duty to write this. And that is what is now called woke racism.
Is it true the working title was Fuck 'em?
The working title was really The Elect, but in my head, I must admit that the working title was Fuck 'em. And that's the smaller side of me, but I can't pretend that I was not angry at the kind of person who was threatening careers and calling people names. It revolts me. I find it utterly revolting. And I want to stress again, I am not thinking only of black people. I am thinking of white people as well, and possibly white people more with this particular book. I'm revolted.
Yeah. And you also say, and throughout the book, actually, that they're not – you don't want to dismiss them as just hotheads, and you don't think that they're bad people, and you don't want to be unduly mean to them. I mean, you're critical, of course, but you also say they're not malicious, it seems like. It seems like you think they have – they're acting in good faith, that they have good intentions, I suppose.
Yeah, they really do. And yeah, they test my patience, and hence the Fuck 'em. And, you know, I do, you know, sometimes dealing with these people, the smugness, the meanness, the nastiness. But I am really loath to say that people are crazy. So all of these people who are, you know, being so mean to a lot of people and seem to almost enjoy making people cry, it's because they think that they're on the side of the angels. And you can't hate anybody for that. They think that they found the answer. They think they found the solution to what life should be about. And for them, the solution, and this isn't senseless, is that you battle power differentials. What's wrong with everything is that some people have undue power over others. And especially when it comes to people with white skin having power over people with dark skin who were brought here against their will, well, that's the main thing. Getting past that should center anything that you do, calling yourself a moral actor. That's not senseless. And you might feel that anybody who gets in the way of that agenda needs to be kicked in the teeth. I fully get that. However, that agenda is extremely narrow. It's extremely oversimplified. And those of us who understand that need to stand up to these people and tell them, no, you are not going to run the show with that ideology. You can harbor it. You can try to affect how we do things with that ideology because it's not senseless. But you cannot run the government. You cannot determine the curriculum of entire schools. You cannot center an entire academic discipline. And if that doesn't happen, what we're going to get is people who are well-intentioned, but whose thought processes are much less enlightened than you might think, despite the fact that they use a lot of big Latinate words.
There are a few disclaimers in the book. I want to get through some of these. It's not an argument against protest. Say something about that. That's a point you make early on.
Yeah, it's not that there should not be protest against injustice. The question is, what is injustice? What is this thing called social justice that these people say that they're finding? So it's not against protest. And I think it's easy to think because, you know, I'm known as the contrarian. I have a snotty voice. If you kind of research me a little bit, you'll find that I did work for 10 years for a conservative think tank. I was one of their token Democrats. They always have many, but many people will assume that I was a Republican, and they'll think that I worked for evil people, although what I was doing was working on prisoner reentry reform, which I don't think of as evil, and that's what the Manhattan Institute was doing. A lot of people are probably going to suppose that I'm the sort of black guy who says everybody needs to just shape up and get over the past and pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and stop running around out in the streets. That is not my point. Black Lives Matter, I think, ultimately has strayed from its original agenda in ways that I don't always agree with, but I'm not bristling when I see people protesting in the streets. It's not against protests. It's what do you protest against and for what reason? And how focused on you are, how focused are you on results as opposed to having protested and doing the protesting and seeing it on Twitter and showing one another that you protested? We're at a point where the gesture alone is being seen as the activism. That's new. And we need to get away from that performative notion of what changing the world is.
I want to come back to the performative idea here in a moment. But one of the things you mention in the book is you explain who it's for. And one of the audiences you say it's for is the New York Times reading, NPR listening people who have, as you put it, fallen under this impression that pious virtue signaling about race is moral enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, John McWhorter, as you think about this audience of white people who are
– some of them are black, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of them – well, right. No, mm-hmm. that's a good point. And mm-hmm. But these are people who want to – let's put it this way, are confused about what to do right now mm-hmm. at this moment of reckoning. They want to be allies. They want to relate. They mm-hmm. want in some ways to atone and do something. They want to acknowledge their level of privilege. But – as you say, it's not whether anyone thinks white privilege is real. It's what, as you say, what we consider the proper response to it. So how do you respond to white people and others who are just confused about wanting to get this right?
Mm-hmm. There are positive things you can do politically. I really do think that if you really want to help Black America, you battle the war on drugs and or you agitate, if you're talking about, for example, parents of students in a school, agitate for phonics-based reading instruction, which is more important than that dull series of word sounds. And you celebrate and agitate for the funding for, and take to the streets about it if necessary, vocational training for underserved people so that they can live middle-class lives without spending 4 years going to college. I really do think those three things would turn Black America upside down. The reason that they seem like thin gruel to many people is because they're not about teaching white people how racist they are. But I'm not sure how much that helps. What that person needs to not do is fall for the idea that the way that you be an ally is to excuse Black people from conventional standards of evaluation. When somebody tells you that to be an ally, you have to agitate for your school to stop using a standardized test to allow people in, you should really stop and think about what that means, because even if there are people with dreadlocks who are telling you that that's the way it's supposed to go, there is a very small jump from doing that to saying Black people aren't smart enough to be tested on their abstract intelligence. Very small step. And so you need to reconsider all sorts of things where the idea is that Black people can't be expected to do things because of slavery, Jim Crow, and redlining. An example being, don't expect Black people to be precise or to be on time or to raise their hand or, frankly, to behave because of the notion of the past. And this is a metric that I used to ask people to use about affirmative action back in the day, and I haven't used it much lately, but would you apply this to your own children? So you can talk until the cows come home about legacies and about Jim Crow and redlining and the memory of a race, et cetera. But would you want your child to be subjected to this version of standards? And if you wouldn't, then you don't want to subject black people to those standards either. Slavery, Jim Crow, and redlining do not make those things different. So you just have to listen to what I think is most people's inner compass instead of being scared by the prospect of somebody saying you're a racist on Twitter and scaring you into doing something that is actually anti-black and often in ways that any 10-year-old can see. We can't be trained into performative anti-racism that hurts black people.
But how much of – how do you think about this idea of there being some really deeply embedded structural impediments? So how do you – how are you – because you write about this, of course, in the book, the idea of structural racism. It's a term that has been coming up a lot lately.
Yeah, and the question is, yes, that exists. I don't think that calling it racism is that useful, but that's not going to stop. Yes, those disparities exist. But the question is, how much is racism an obstacle to people getting past those disparities? And or to undo those disparities, is the solution to spray for racism? Or is it that racism created those disparities in the past, but today we need other strategies? And so, for example, structural racism, especially if you look at it historically, is why, for example, many black teens think of school as something white, as something that isn't really the black thing to do. There's a whole story about that in the past. It goes into the 60s and early 70s. But the people who were racist against black kids amidst desegregation and made them feel like school was the white man's game are now all either 70 or dead. It was a very long time ago, and addressing the racism of some retiree who was a mean teacher in 1969 doesn't really help anybody today. Today, you have to teach those kids that that version of identity isn't very productive. And there are all sorts of educational strategies that great people have suggested where the idea is to work against black kids' idea that school is something that white kids do, because the consequences for that in any lifetime trajectory are clear. But if you want to look at it as if these kids don't like school, it's because racism. Well, then you're going to go fight, you know, subtle racist biases that you might be able to still find in white students and white teachers that have nothing to do with the kids feeling that way today. What made kids feel that way and pass it on as a meme in the way teens do, it now happened during the Nixon administration. You can't go back to that. And so, yes, structural racism exists, but the idea that saying systemic racism is a mic drop against anybody who questions what we're calling the racial reckoning today is very simplistic reasoning, which once again, this time somebody would have to be older than 10, but somebody about 14 would look at that and say, no, okay, there is that disparity, but does that mean that we're going to battle racism now? Is that what would change it? And if you don't have a real answer to that, it's because you're looking at these things with basic logic as opposed to through the religious lens that we've been taught to do this, especially since 2020.
That's the writer and linguist John McWhorter. His new book is Woke Racism: How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Listener support makes programming possible on KUER. You can easily manage your donation anytime with MyKUER. It's a place to go to update your contact information, find tax receipts, change the amount of your donation, or switch payment methods. For example, you can update that expired credit card with a direct donation from your bank account. Sign into your personal online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the writer and linguist John McWhorter about his provocative new book, Woke Racism. In it, he makes the case for how this movement of activism ignited by the murder of George Floyd has become excessive and irrational. McWhorter says it casts all white people as innately privileged and bigoted and all black people as victims. He says this way of thinking has created an irrational culture of hypersensitivity that's become embedded in universities and corporations. And he argues it's become a new religion, but it's not actually helping black people. One of the principal arguments, and it's conveyed in the subtitle of the book, is that this new ideology is actually a a religion. And that's not just a rhetorical comparison. As you say in the book, an anthropologist would see no difference in type between Pentecostalism and this new form of anti-racism. Take me through some of the comparisons here between this ideology and religion.
Well, for one thing, many have a question. Why do people like this get so angry? Why do they think that a person needs to be fired? Why do they say, I can't be in the room and listen to this? Why are they so intolerant? And the truth is, often the person in question on any other topic except the ones that concern the elect is not that intolerant. It's not that the people are crazy. Nobody is crazy. Almost nobody is crazy. The reason they act like that is because they sense the person in opposition not as somebody with a different opinion, but as a heretic. That is behavior that we're all familiar with from people who consider, say, the unbeliever to be unsavory and almost physically dirty, and they can't bear to be near them. So either the people who are that intolerant and, you know, are firing people for no reason are crazy. And that's a lazy analogy. Or they're being religious. The heresy is modeled on Christianity. It's not at all surprising. Original sin in Christianity, white privilege in the elect. I need say no more. Or the fact that you're not supposed to ask questions too much. There's a point at which, you know, your priest can't answer your question about, you know, free will, why God allows such terrible things to happen. And you're just supposed to have faith. There's an extent to which it's not all going to make perfect sense. That's just something that you accept when as part of a religion. That's not that religion makes no sense, but part of a religion often involves that you suspend disbelief. Same thing here. If somebody says, well, you know, a black guy in a certain kind of community is much more likely to be killed by another black guy than by a stray white cop coming in and making a mistake or even being a bad white cop. Much, much more likely to be killed within their own community by somebody who lives there. And yet, what the media is interested in is that stray white cop. Not that there's no interest in what goes on in the communities, but there's much, 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 much less. Well, why? Because the mother who has seen two of her boys killed, one of them by a cop, one of them by somebody who lived three blocks away, feels the same way about both. Why are we more interested in the fact that one of them was killed by a white person? That only makes sense as part of this imperative to show one another that you know that racism exists. And you're not supposed to ask too many questions. Push that point too hard, eyes roll, cheeks turn red, people turn away, because you're not supposed to ask. You're supposed to suspend your disbelief. This is a religion. And we don't use religious words to describe these things. You know, hegemony, you know, anti-racist, equity, social justice, those aren't religious words. We think of those as socio-political words, but words and reality often don't match. And yes, I say, a naive anthropologist, it would have to be an extremely naive one. It would be a Martian. A Martian would see people worshiping in a Pentecostal church, and then a Martian would go to a university campus and listen to certain conversations, and they would see no difference at all. I know that is absolutely true. And we need to think about that. What place does religion have in our society? What place does religion have within a state? We're losing sight of that because of just an issue of language versus reality.
Another point you make on that theme is you compare the elect to the Pharisees in the Bible. Say something about that. You mentioned the idea that they're obsessed with the letter of the law, not the spirit.
Yeah, it's the letter of the law. You show that you know racism exists, regardless of the consequences or the lack of consequences, as opposed to being actually concerned with the fate and the lives of black people who are the ones who are subject to this racism that you claim to be so interested in. And that is an accusation I would make of a black person of this frame of mind as well. You're really interested in identifying where racism is, but what about actually helping people either battle it or, more to the point, as we used to think of in the civil rights movement, get past the racism? It surprises me that we all celebrate the Dr. Kings, et cetera, who never had any sense that the idea was to make whites not racist. The idea was to make it so that there weren't concrete barriers to achievement. There wasn't enforced segregation. And then as far as what's going on in white hearts, we'll table that. But the idea that our self-regard is dependent on white people seeing us absolutely fully, and we're going to obsess with white people not quite seeing us fully in little ways like you're taught to think of and obsess over in Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, that would have seemed like science fiction to people working on race in 1955. I think it should now as well. But yes, it is like the Pharisees. These are people who are concerned with showing that you know racism exists, and then everybody slaps hands and you've done the right thing, as opposed to helping people who have real problems. I really do think the second thing is more important, and we need to reconsider why we're so interested in the performance rather than the action itself.
So one of the things, help us if you would, John McWhorter, sort of situate these various waves of anti-racism in history, because you identify these three waves. The first, which is the fight against slavery and legalized segregation. The second is this struggle against racist attitudes, the idea that racial prejudice was a moral defect. That came of that. So far, so good. But the third wave hasn't worked as well. What's been the difference between the third wave and those others?
Well, the third wave is less psychologically plausible than the other ones. The first was about the legal. Then the second was really revolutionary in teaching people that racism is a bad thing. And I lived through it as a kid. And so to me, it's totemic. I'm not sure most people think of there having been a second wave in that way. But there was a time when white Americans who were open to it in particular learned that racism is not just what happened in Birmingham and Jim Crow. That was important. But now we're being asked to have this idea that white people are extremely and urgently culpable in even being part of an abstractly racist system. The complicity is something that white people need to learn how to atone for by, and frankly, the X, Y, and Z following are kind of vague, because really what it's all about is just the act of atonement and, you know, showing that you understand that racism exists. But that one is harder, because it's very difficult to tell most individuals you are guilty for something much larger than yourself that got that way because of things that happened in the past. There's a gestural aspect to insisting that black people cannot be appeased until something like that happens, especially because it's a rather intellectual conceit. That's a lot of what third wave anti-racism is. And third wave anti-racism is also that black people should be proud to explain why we can't do things as opposed to how we can. You read people writing about civil rights, black people writing about civil rights, black civil leaders writing about it. In the 60s, when racism is still naked, if segregation is gone, it was only about 10 minutes ago. And the idea is, what can we do? Somebody like Rustin is writing about things like that. Here's what we can do. Already they were being seen as old-fashioned, because there was a new fashion coming in, which was to loudly explain, we can't do anything until, despite the fact that there had been the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the redlining-averse Fair Housing Act of 1968. After that, still, there was a certain kind saying, we need more, or everything's just going to stay the way it is. That fashion was peculiar. I think it was extremely damaging to the black psyche. And that's third wave anti-racism. What's the difference between 1968 and now is that a critical mass of whites have jumped on to looking at things in that same way. And it's disempowering. And more to the point, not only is it disempowering, some people would say it may be disempowering, but it's correct. But the thing is, it isn't. Nobody ever said that the conditions in the United States since about 1968 aren't enough for a people to succeed. It's just that a certain mood led to an idea that the blackest thing is to loudly and charismatically proclaim that it is. Now we're being joined by white wokesters who think of this as advanced because they hear black people saying it, and they're being taught that they've been taught that what you do is you show that you're not a racist. Well, one way to show you're not a racist is to accept anything that a black person says at face value. Well, the thing is, if you accept anything any human being says at face value, especially when it doesn't seem to quite make sense, I hate to say it, but you're being a racist, because that's not the way we ever evaluate one another. And so we have, frankly, a darned mess. Third wave anti-racism. Maybe in 50 years, somebody will look back and hear somebody like me as just having not gotten it. Maybe I'm older than I think. Maybe I'm not thinking ahead. But I doubt it. I think that what we're doing now is this postmodern kind of virtue signaling kabuki as opposed to what we actually could be doing, which is making lives better for real people, despite the inevitable imperfections of white as well as everybody else's psychology.
You say that white people calling themselves the saviors of black people make black people, as you put it in the book, look like the dumbest, weakest, most self-indulgent human beings in the history of our species. So this is where you're getting at the idea that it's racist, is it's infantilizing black people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We don't need to be treated like the hothouse flowers that we're told. And by that, I don't mean that there isn't an issue with the cops, although I think, as many people know, that the cop issue is much less racially oriented than we tend to think. And I say that based on just statistics. And there's a media distortion of that, which is understandable. It's part of the whole woke imperative. But still, there is a cop problem. I'm not saying that a black person who's being harassed or threatened by a cop needs to stop being a hothouse flower. But there is a great deal more to the black experience than what happens with cops, contrary to what we're often told. And what we are being told is that black people need to be assumed to not be up for tests. Black people need to be assumed to not be able to watch white people crying about racism because that takes the spotlight off of us. That's right out of Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility. That black people are not to be expected to adhere to basic standards of the law, that if black people riot after what happened to George Floyd, and not just right after it, but repeatedly in various cities quite far from what happened to George Floyd, if a certain element of the black community riots, we have to see them as freedom fighters rather than criminals. All of this is patting black people on the head. And you may feel like somebody who's been through so much deserves a pat on the head, but black people are not one person. That's an anthropomorphization that itself is a kind of primitive thought. Black people need to be held to account in the same way as everyone else, not more. And if we find that black people are being held to account more, then that should be shouted to the heavens. But too often these days, the idea is to hold black people to account less out of a vague, wet, weepy, self-gratifying sense that that's what you do to show that you're not racist. But that's not what helps black people. It's what helps you.
You also mentioned some misimpressions. The impression, for example, that most black people are poor. And you go through this list of black success. Would take me through that, if you would.
It's important to realize that the idea that most black people are poor is way, way out of date. And one way we know it is that if a white person comes out and actually says that the essence of being black is living in some ghetto scape, then everybody in the black community, including people who are living in off neighborhoods, very loudly condemn this stereotyping. Very simply, most black people are not poor by any metric that we use of poverty. Now, some people will hear that and then massage the figures or say, even if you're living above the poverty line, you still have problems. And all that's true, but still, most black people are not poor, and more to the point, the black middle class is enormous. To be a black middle class person is no longer what used to be called fortunate. Now, well, you're fortunate, but you are no longer a sliver or even a big giant chunk. At this point, black middle classness and even affluence are normal. They're perfectly normal. There is a segment of the black community that needs saving. And that segment of the black community definitely needs saving. The idea is not for them to just shape up. I'm not somebody who would say that. But the idea of blackness as a tragedy, the idea that black people simply cannot advance very far without very, very, very special treatment, including reparations, at this distant point after the civil rights victories of the 50s and 60s, it's simply not true. At this point, it's just a position that people strike because it affords a certain comfort to people on both sides of the racial divide.
One of the things you say in the book is that racism, and you've sort of been mentioning this already, racism is a matter of the past as well as the present and these attitudes and policies, but something you say this layered, something this timeless, should be restrained, of course. You do mention that, of course, but you also say it's impossible to simply get rid of. And you say doing so is not necessary. What do you mean getting rid of racism is not necessary?
Well, for one thing, we can assume that racism is part of being human, quite unfortunately. But the fact that it's unfortunate doesn't mean that it's wrong to say so or that it's not true. Racism is hardwired in us, and so you can lessen it And in the United States, more than just about anywhere else in the world, we have lessened it to an incredible and unprecedented degree. But you can't get rid of all of it. And in general, there's this predication. We must maybe not get rid of all racism, but we have to lessen it significantly more before Black America can truly overcome. I'm not sure where that's been proven. Sounds good, especially because it gives a white person the opportunity to stand and, you know, wave their arms and show that they know racism exists. But frankly, I'm not sure where we get that, because nobody was thinking that in the civil rights movement as late as, say, 1965. And more to the point, let's try something else. Every summer in any big city, Black teens in inner cities start shooting each other. Hundreds of kids die, often over nothing in particular. It's these little turf wars and things like that. Hundreds of kids die, to the point that in that city, when you're reading the Sunday paper and you learn that three people were killed over the weekend in Chicago, a little part of you thinks they were Black kids. And that little part of you is always correct. Those things did not happen in a white neighborhood. They may have happened in a Latino neighborhood, but they did not happen in a white neighborhood. They did not happen in an Asian neighborhood, and not even a poor Asian neighborhood. So that is a problem in the Black community. Tracing why that is, there are all sorts of things you can trace it to. Black pathology is not one of them. However, there is a disparity. In Chicago, every summer, many, many, many more Black kids die, and all of them essentially at the hands of one another, than white kids. Now, somebody like Ibram Kendi says, when I see disparities, I see racism. Okay, well, what do you do with that? Now, you can talk about the racism that led in a kind of Rube Goldberg mousetrap fashion to what those kids are doing last summer and this summer coming, as opposed to what the kids in the white neighborhoods, including the working class white neighborhoods sometimes, are doing. You can say that. All right. But racism now, is the way that you solve that problem to go looking for racism, or is it an issue of gun control and community organizations that teach people to tamp it down and any number of other things? When I see disparities, I see racism, and everybody claps. Okay, now, that kid who got shot last weekend and those two kids who are going to get shot over in the next neighborhood next weekend, do you see racism there? If you do, you're using such an abstract vision of racism that it's of no use to any of us. And we don't even have to be that deep about it. Here in the present, how is racism making those kids kill each other? Is it because, now this is something that you hear from the more gifted writers, they're killing each other because society doesn't love them. Well, really? Is that why? You wouldn't get that if you asked them. And frankly, that's made up. That's making Black people into characters in books. That's not why they're killing each other. And so the whole business of seeing racism behind all disparities, it isn't productive. And surely we can do better than that in trying to figure out why in cities across the country every summer hundreds of Black kids kill each other. Racism? No. If it was in the past. You can't reach back to the past. What do we do now? Our discussion is extremely unimaginative about that.
John McWhorter, his new book is Woke Racism. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Public Radio brings you vital information, and it keeps you company whatever your day looks like, providing moments of levity and joy along with the news. Stay connected at home. Just ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name.
It's easy to hear the news that you trust when you tell your smart speaker, play KUER. To learn more about listening with your smart speaker, go to KUER.org/smartspeaker.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the linguist and writer John McWhorter. We're talking about his new book, Woke Racism, How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. So the book came out this week. I'm sure you're already getting responses and reaction. I'm sure you're anticipating some. You anticipate some in the book itself, the idea that what you're saying is a philosophical tempest in a teapot, you know, it's often referred to as a moral panic, that the real problem isn't the left, it's the right. How are you responding to some of those ideas, that what you're doing is cherry picking some examples that maybe this happens occasionally in academia, but this is a moral panic that you're engaged in, John McCoy.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's all, none of that is true. A lot of the people who think I should not be saying these things because what's going on with the right wing is more important are just people who are in the left wing and don't like hearing themselves called out. And I can completely understand that. But when we're talking about something that's threatening our academic, our educational, as in schools for kids, our judicial, as in what we consider morality, and our artistic institutions, to tell me that the takeover of that by a religious ideology that starkly limits what can be said and tries to limit what can even be thought, to tell me that's not a problem is frankly so out of court that I think it barely deserves an answer. Yes, what happened on the Capitol steps on January 6th was a terrible thing. Yes, there are racist hate groups, but I would have to ask, what institutions are those people taking over? And I'm not sure that I see it. I see what I'm talking about as a grievous problem in our nation today. And if the extent to which this is happening doesn't matter, then I'm afraid that to an extent we're seeing the grand old American anti-intellectual tradition. I say, look what's happening to our schools and our art and our legal theory. And somebody says, oh, no big whoop. Well, okay, that's on you. That's fine. So yeah, there's definitely going to be some of that. And, you know, I mean, I've been, sometimes I wonder why, but I've been commenting on race now for over 20 years. So I've heard it all many times from all sides. And you know, I'm going to get all that stuff as usual. But I think that what I have written about in this book is a really serious problem. And the reason I wrote it is because I am trying to protect Black people. I really do feel that the Black community is in a kind of danger from this misguided sense of what anti-racism and a racial reckoning is. And, you know, for those who, you know, are going to insist that what happened on the Capitol steps is more important, well, maybe that's just what they find more interesting. For those who think that I'm some sort of conservative right winger who's trying to play to racist white audiences, have fun with that. It has nothing to do with my career, and that's painfully clear from everything that I write and say. And so I just hope that I can contribute to a real dialogue about what a racial reckoning could be. We can have a racial reckoning, but not a racial reckoning that pats Black people on the heads and says, you're all special needs people, and it makes us good people to pretend that. No, I stand athwart that movement, and I will continue to.
You mentioned sort of in passing earlier, and we don't have to spend much time with it. People should get to the book and go through it. But three solutions that you lay out: get rid of the war on drugs, teach everybody to read the right way, which is through phonics, and then to, as you say, make solid vocational training as easy to obtain as a college education. And the question that comes from that is, as you say in the book, that's it? You know, three very basic solutions. And one of the things you say is you tried to keep it simple because you really want this to be incredibly pragmatic.
Yeah. There are 18,000 police precincts, all of them only fitfully beholden to what many of us would consider the proper constraints of justice. That's a massive amount of work to do. So what many people are waiting for is for me to say something about the cops. I'm not sure how pragmatic that is. I want to see, you know, bail issues reformed. I want to see cops being held more responsible for the sorts of things they do, the great blue wall of silence coming down. And I see some of that happening. There's a conversation about police immunity happening. That's going to be so slow, though. And there are 18,000 districts. And there's no one person who can wave a magic wand and change it. There's no police god. And so, thinking about what Black America needs, I think not that the cops don't matter, but what can we do to make it so that fewer Black men in particular encounter cops in situations where they're in danger of being subject to the mistakes that cops make, to the biases that infect what cops do? So, end the war on drugs. That would take care of, frankly, most of that. Most of the reason that Black men are incarcerated disproportionately is not necessarily because of drug possession or sale, but things related to those things. Why do disproportionate numbers of Black men steal? Why is there disproportionate violence? Why are a lot of those Black kids killing each other over the weekends in cities? It's turf wars. What's the turf? They're in gangs. What do the gangs do? They don't dance
to music in a gym. That's not what the gangs are doing. The gangs often sell drugs, and so it's drug territory. All of it's related. Take away that war on drugs, and black men would encounter the cops much less. Then, because you don't have the temptation of that black market on the street, which many sensible people take. I can easily imagine doing it myself if I grew up in neighborhoods like that. Instead, you get legal work after high school. Maybe you don't want to go to college. Everybody doesn't have to go to college, but you get legal work. Vocational training should be available to you. You shouldn't have to pay for it. It should be good. It should be near your house. You learn to be an electrician. You learn to be an ultrasound technologist. You learn to be any number of things where you can have a perfectly good middle-class existence and not go to jail, not get hurt, be there for your kids. All of that would turn the black community upside down in a generation. And that black guy who, instead of selling drugs on the side to make half of his living, that guy becomes an electrician. If your light switch doesn't work, you invite that person over. Talk to your electrician the next time he's black and ask whether he's having a terrible life, whether he feels held down, whether he feels oppressed by the white man. He's an electrician. And that guy whose job is to fix your switches and to put a wire in the wall in the closet, etc., he's never going to run into a cop. There's going to be none of that. He's not going to go to prison. We need that. This, for me, is pro-black agitation. Not me telling people to calm down. It's what do black people need? And I would like to see those things. I've been fighting for an end to the war on drugs now for almost 15 years. Big point of mine, because I really do think it would be the key to turning things around in the black community. But to see somebody saying we need to sit with our hands on our legs and examine ourselves for our complicity in a racist system, you know, that's for white people. And black people are supposed to stand there and coach you in doing this. No, that has nothing to do with what actually helping people on the ground is. People should learn to be electricians. That's what my three propositions are for.
You're calling for, it's a reference to Solzhenitsyn, you're calling for a kind of civil valor, a kind of courage to stand up to this kind of thinking. What are the prospects for that? Are you seeing hopeful things, or do you imagine people will have the ability to stand up to these things in the future?
I'm seeing evidence of it. I think that part of why a certain group of people said this is how the racial reckoning is going to go and everybody just said okay was because we were inside. A lot of this happened on Zoom and on Slack. A lot of this happened when a lot of us had a whole lot more to think about. But I think the excess in the way a lot of these people exert their elect religion is so clear that we're seeing more and more examples, such as some of the ones that I list at the end of the book, of people who are just standing up to it and saying, no, I will not say that I'm a racist, or no, we will not change this school's entire curriculum to focus only on battling power differentials. No, I will not apologize when you have told me that I used a word in this letter that's a racist slur where nobody else thinks it's a racist slur. Just no. And we need more and more people to do that, upon which the elect kind of person will realize that they can't have everything they want just by proposing that what they want falls under the category of racial reckoning and social justice and therefore cannot be rejected by good thinking people. I think we're going to see more of that. People would ask me that 6 months ago, and I said it was too early to tell. But I'm beginning to see, I hate to say, a backlash against these people. And the idea is not that they should leave the room. They should go back to where they were in, say, March 2020, which was making their case from the sidelines, as all of us do. That's the consensus upon which a society moves. What they're doing, though, is much more primitive, alarmingly reminiscent of Bolshevism and the Cultural Revolution. And more to the point, and the reason that I wrote Woke Racism is it hurts black people. I don't like to see black people hurt.
Let me ask you finally, you don't sound terribly worried about the consequences of this book. I mean, here's what you write early on, and something you've sort of conveyed throughout the conversation, frankly. You write early on, I will be dismissed as self-hating, but frankly, they don't really mean it. And anyone who gets through the book will see that I'm not ashamed of being black. And here's how you write it. And we shall move on. Do you really think that people will just move on? Or are you bracing for something more furious, ferocious?
I'm sorry. I've been around too long. There are always going to be people out there who have this cartoon vision of me. but I'm too busy cranking work out to think much about that. And I'm just one writer. If you mean, am I afraid I'm going to get fired from my job? I think about it sometimes, but I have arranged things so that I would not starve if it happened. And I know that a great many people, if that happened, would stand by and know that it wasn't just. And I wrote a book called Losing the Race in the year 2000. People hated me to death for it, and some of them still do. And I'm still here. And as you learn, there is the intellectual and the media kind of person. And they, of course, you know, and I'm in that group. We have a disproportionate pulpit, but I have literally 2,000 pieces of paper, because this was long enough ago that people would actually write you physical letters, of people who love losing the race. Very few of them are from conservative white people. The vast majority are from black people. Those people weren't writing reviews on Amazon. They weren't writing to me through email, but that's how they felt. And I know that there are a great many people today, including black ones, who understand that I'm just trying to make some sense of things. But yeah, are there going to be people who think that I'm horrible? Sure, I'll make it through. That's just the nature of these things. And we will move on, as we always have. But no, if you mean, am I afraid of what the response is going to be? No, not in the slightest.
John McWhorter, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
John McWhorter, his new book is Woke Racism: How a New Religion Has Betrayed Black America. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Stu Nolan. The program is produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.